time is 8 p.m. You're listening to KVMR FM, Nevada City. My name is T.E. Wolf. This is A Word in Edgewise. Tonight's program, I'll be reading excerpts from the novel Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. We were fractious and overpaid. Our mornings lacked promise. At least those of us who smoked had something to look forward to at 10:15. Most of us liked most everyone. A few of us hated specific individuals. One or two people loved everyone and everything. Those who loved everyone were unanimously reviled. We loved free bagels in the morning. They happened all too infrequently. Our benefits were astonishing in comprehensiveness and quality of care. Sometimes we questioned whether they were worth it. We thought moving to India might be better, or going back to nursing school, doing something with the handicapped, or working with our hands. No one ever acted on these impulses, despite their daily, sometimes hourly, contractions. Instead, we met in conference rooms to discuss the issues of the day. Ordinarily, jobs came in and we completed them in a timely and professional manner. Sometimes screw-ups did occur. Printing errors, transposed numbers. Our business was advertising and details were important. If the third number after the second hyphen in a client's toll-free number was a 6 instead of an 8, and if it went to print like that and showed up in Time magazine, no one would reading the ad could call now and order today. No matter that they could go to the website, we still had to eat the price of the ad. Is this boring you yet? It bored us every day. Our boredom was ongoing, a collective boredom, and it would never die because we would never die. Lynn Mason was dying. She was a partner in the agency. Dying. It was uncertain. She was in her early 40s, breast cancer. No one can identify exactly how everyone had come to know this fact. Was it a fact? Some people called it rumor. But in fact, there was no such thing as rumor. There was fact, and there was what did not come up in conversation. Breast cancer was controllable if caught in the early stages, but Lynn may have waited too long. The news of Lynn brought Frank Brizalera to mind. We recalled looking at Frank and thinking he had 6 months tops. Old Briz, we called him. He smoked like a fiend. He stood outside the building in the most inclement weather, absorbing old golds in nothing but a sweater vest. Then, and only then, he looked indomitable. When he returned inside, nicotine stink preceded him as he walked down the hall, where it lingered long after he entered his office. He began to cough, and from our own offices we heard the working up of solidified lung sediment. Some people put him on their celebrity death watch every year because of the coughing, even though he wasn't an official celebrity. He knew it, too. He knew he was on death watch and that certain wagering individuals would profit from his death. He knew it because he was one of us, and we knew everything. Thank you. didn't know who was stealing things from other people's workstations. Always small items, postcards, framed photographs. We had our suspicions, but no proof. We believed it was probably not for the loot so much as the excitement, the shoplifter's addictive kick. Maybe it was a pathological cry for help. Hank Neary, one of the agency's only black riders, asked, "Come on now, who would want my travel toothbrush?" We didn't know who was responsible for putting the sushi roll behind Joe Pope's bookshelf. The first couple of days, Joe had no clue about the sushi. Then he started taking furtive sniffs at his pits and holding the wall of his palm to his mouth to get blowback from his breath. By the end of the week, he was certain it wasn't him. We smelled it, too. Persistent, high in the nostrils, it became worse than a dying animal. Joe's gorge rose every time he entered the office. The following week, the smell was so atrocious, the building people got involved, hunting the office for what turned out to be a sunshine roll, tuna, whitefish, salmon, and sprouts. Mike Boroshansky, the chief of security, kept bringing his tie up to his nose as if he were a real cop at the scene of a murder. We thanked each other. It was customary after every exchange. Our thanks were never disingenuous or ironic. We said thanks for getting this done so quickly. Thanks for putting in so much effort. We had a meeting, and then when the meeting was over, we said thank you to the meeting makers for having made the meeting. Very rarely did we say anything negative or derogatory about meetings. We all knew there was a good deal of pointlessness to nearly all the meetings, and in fact, one meeting out of every three or four was nearly perfectly without gain or purpose, but many meetings revealed the one thing that was necessary. And so we attended them, and afterward, we said thank you to each other. Karen Wu always had something new to tell us, and we hated her guts for it. She would start talking and our eyes would glaze over. Might it be true, as we sometimes feared on the commute home, that we were callous, unfeeling individuals, incapable of sympathy, full of spite toward people for no reason other than their proximity and familiarity? We had these sudden revelations that employment, the daily 9-to-5, was driving us far from our better selves. Should we quit? Would that solve it? Or were these qualities innate, dooming us to nastiness and paucity of spirit? We hope not. Marcia Dwyer became famous for sending an email to Genevieve Latko-Devine. Marcia often wrote to Genevieve after meetings. "It is really irritating to work with irritating people," she once wrote. There she ended it and waited for Genevieve's response. Usually, when she got Genevieve's email, instead of writing back, which would take too long, Marcia was an art director, not a writer, she would head down to Genevieve's office, close the door, and the two women would talk. The only thing bearable about the irritating event involving the irritating person was the thought of telling it all to Genevieve, who would understand better than anyone else. Marcia could have called her mother would have listened. She could have called one of her four brothers. Any one of those South Side pipe ends would have been more than happy to beat up the irritating person. But they would not have understood. They would have sympathized, but that was not the same thing. Genevieve would hardly need to nod for Marcia to know she was getting through. Did we not all understand the essential need for someone to understand? But the email Marcia got back was not from Genevieve. It was from Jim Jackers. "Are you talking about me?" he wrote. Amber Ludwig wrote, "I'm not Genevieve." Benny Schatzberger wrote, "I think you goofed." Tom Moda wrote, "Ha!" Marcia was mortified. She got 65 emails in 2 minutes. One from Human Resources cautioned her against sending personal emails. Jim wrote a second time, "Can you please tell me, is it me, Marcia? Am I the irritating person you're talking about?" Actually, Marcia wanted to eat Jim's heart, because some mornings he shuffled up to the elevators and greeted us by saying, "What up, my niggas?" He meant it ironically in an effort to be funny, but he was just not the man to pull it off. It made us cringe, especially Marcia, especially if Hank was present. In those days, it wasn't rare for someone to push someone else down the hall really fast in a swivel chair. Games aside, we spent most of our time inside long, silent pauses as we bent over our individual desks, working on some task at hand, lost to it. Until Benny, bored, came and stood in the doorway. "What are you up to?" he'd ask. It could have been any of us. "Working," was the usual reply. Then Benny would tap his topaz class ring on the doorway and drift away. How we hated our coffee mugs, our mouse pads, our desk clocks, our daily calendars, the contents of our desk drawers. Even the photos of our loved ones taped to our computer monitors for uplift and support turned into cloying reminders of time served. But when we got a new office, when we got that bigger office, we brought everything with us into the new office, how we loved everything all over again. We thought hard about where to place things and looked with satisfaction at the end of the day at how well our old things looked in this new, improved, important space. There was no doubt in our minds just then that we had made all the right decisions, whereas most days we were men and women of two minds. Everywhere you looked, in the hallways and bathrooms, the coffee bar and cafeteria, the lobbies and the print stations, there we were with our two minds. There seemed to be only the one electric pencil sharpener in the whole damn place. We didn't have much patience for cynics. Everyone was a cynic at one point or another, but it did us little good to bemoan our unbelievable fortunes. At the national level, things had worked out pretty well in our favor. Entrepreneurial cash was easy to come by. Cars available for domestic purchase, cars that could barely fit in our driveways, had a martial appeal, a promise that once inside them, no harm would come to our children. It was IPO this and IPO that. Everyone knew a banker, too. And how lovely it was, a bike ride around the forest preserve on a Sunday in May with our mountain bikes, water bottles, and safety helmets. Crime was at an all-time low, and we heard accounts of former welfare recipients holding steady jobs. New hair products were being introduced into the marketplace every day. And the glass shelves of our stylists were stacked with tidy rows of them, which we eyed in the mirror as we made small talk, each of us certain, "There's one up there just for me." Still, some of us had a hard time finding boyfriends. Some of us had a hard time making love with our wives. Some days we met in the kitchen on 60 to eat lunch. There was only room for 8 at the table. If all the seats were full, Jim Jackers would have to eat his sandwich from the sink and try to engage from over in that direction. It was fortunate for us in that he could pass us a spoon or a packet of salt if we needed it. "It is really irritating," Tom Moda said to the table, "to work with irritating people." "Screw you, Tom," Marcia replied. Headhunters hounded us. They plied us with promises of better titles and increases in pay. Some of us went, but most of us stayed. We liked our prospects where we were and didn't care for the hassle of meeting new people. It had taken us a while to familiarize ourselves and to feel comfortable. First day on the job, names went in one ear and out the other. One minute you were being introduced to a guy with a head of fiery red hair and fair skin crawling with freckles. Before you knew it, you had moved on to someone new, and then someone after that. A few weeks would go by, gradually you'd start to put the name to the face, and one day it just clicked, to be wedged there forever. The eager redhead's name was Jim Jackers. There was no more confusing him with Benny Schassberger, whose name you tended to see on emails and handouts, but hadn't come to recognize yet as the slightly heavy-set, dough-faced Jewish guy with the corkscrew curls and quick laugh. So many people. So many body types, hair colors, fashion statements. Marcia Dwyer's hair was stuck in the 80s. She listened to terrible music, bands we had outgrown in the 11th grade. Some of us had never even heard of the music she listened to. It was inconceivable that she could enjoy such noise. Others of us didn't like music at all. Some preferred talk radio. Still others, there was a larger contingent that kept their radios turned to the oldies station. After everyone went home for the night, after we all fell asleep and the city dimmed, oldies continued to play inside the abandoned office. Picture it. Only a parallelogram of light in the doorway. A happy tune by the Drifters issuing in the dark at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, when elsewhere murders were taking place, drug deals, unspeakable assaults. Crime was down, but it had yet to be rendered obsolete. In the mornings, our favorite DJs were back on, playing our favorite oldies. Most of us ate the crumbs. And then the rest of the muffin. They were the same songs that would play throughout a nuclear winter. We had visceral, rich memories of dull, interminable hours. Then a day would pass in perfect harmonies with our projects. Our family members and our co-workers. We couldn't believe we were getting paid for this. We decided to celebrate with wine at dinner. Some of us liked one restaurant in particular, while others spread out across the city, sampling and reviewing. We were foxes and hedgehogs that way. It was vitally important to Karen Wu that she be the first to know of a new restaurant. If someone mentioned a new restaurant Karen didn't know about, you could bet your bottom dollar that Karen would be there that very night, sampling and reviewing. And when she came in the next morning, she told us, those of us who didn't know about the other person's knowing about the new restaurant she'd just been to, how great it was, and how we all had to go there. Those of us who followed Karen's suggestion gave the same advice to those of us who hadn't heard Karen's suggestion. Soon we were all running into one another at the new restaurant. By then, Karen wouldn't be caught dead there. Early in the time of balanced budgets and the remarkable rise of the NASDAQ, we were given polo shirts of quality cotton with the agency's logo stitched on the left breast. The shirt was for some team event, and everyone wore it out of company pride. After the event was over, it was uncommon to see anyone wearing that polo again, not because we had lost our company pride, but because it was vaguely embarrassing to be seen wearing something everyone knew had been given to you for free, After all, our portfolios were stuffed with NASDAQ offerings, and if our parents had only been able to buy us outfits from Sears, we could now afford Brooks Brothers and had no need for free shirts. We gave them to the Goodwill, or they languished in our drawers, or we put them on to mow the lawn. A few years later, Tom Moda exhumed his company pride polo from some box of clothes under his bed. Likely he found it when the Moda family chattels were being divided up by order of a judge. He wore it to work. He had worn the polo along with the rest of us on that polo-wearing day. But his life had changed dramatically since then, and we thought it was an indication of where his head was at that he didn't mind being seen in a shirt most of us used to wash our cars. It really was a very handy cotton. Then Tom wore the same shirt the next day. We wondered where he was sleeping. On the third day, we were concerned about his showering. When Tom passed an entire week in the same polo, we expected it to give off an odor. But he must have been washing it, and we pictured him bare-chested at the laundromat watching his one polo turn in the dryer because his wife wouldn't let him return to his Naperville home. By the end of the month, we figured out finally it had nothing to do with Tom's divorce. 30 straight days in the same corporate polo. It was the beginning of Tom's campaign of agitation. "You ever going to change out of it?" asked Benny. "I love this shirt. I want to be buried in it." "Would you take mine, at least, so you can switch off?" "I would love that," said Tom. So Benny gave Tom his polo, but Tom didn't use it to switch off. Instead, he wore Benny's on top of his own. Two polos, one under the other. He approached the rest of us and solicited our polos as well. Jim Jackers grasped at any opportunity to ingratiate himself, and soon Tom was walking around in three polos. Tom, Lynn Mason's starting to ask questions," said Benny. "Company pride," said Tom. "But three at a time?" "You don't know what's in my heart," said Tom, pounding his fist against the corporate logo three times. "Company pride." Some days green was on top, some days red, some days blue. Later we found out he was the one responsible for taping the sunshine roll to the back of Joe Pope's bookshelf. He was responsible for many things, including changing everyone's radio stations, making pornographic screensavers, and leaving his seed on the floor of the men's rooms of floors 60 and 61. We know he was responsible because once he was laid off, the radios went unmolested and the custodians no longer complained to management. It was the era of take-ones and tchotchkes. The world was flush with internet cash, and we got our fair share of it. It was our position that logo design was every bit as important as product performance and distribution systems. "Wicked cool" were the words we used to describe our logo designs. "Bush League" were the words we used to describe the logo designs of other agencies. Unless it was a really well-designed logo, in which case we bowed down before it, much like the ancient Mayans did their pagan gods. We, too, thought it would never end.
Hey!
Layoffs were upon us. They had been rumored for months, but now it was official. If you were lucky, you could sue. If you were black, aged, female, Catholic, Jewish, gay, obese, or physically handicapped, at least you had grounds. At one point or another, we have all been deposed. We plan on being deposed for Tom's suit. We have no doubt there will be one. Though he has no grounds unless a-hole has been added to the list. And that's not just us talking. His ex-wife hates the guy. Restraining order. He can't see his two young kids without supervision. She moved to Phoenix just to get away from him. We wouldn't call him an a-hole without having reached a very high consensus. Amber Ludwig objects to the specific designation because she has objected to profanity since becoming pregnant, but really there is no other word, and her objection is really just an abstention. When Tom found out he was being let go, he wanted to throw his computer against his office window. Benny Schassberger was in there with him. Benny wasn't like a great friend of Tom's or anything, but he was the guy who, on occasion, would have lunch with Tom and then report back to the rest of us. Word spread fast that Tom had been laid off, and naturally, Benny was the guy to go down there. He said Tom was pacing in his office, like a man recently jailed. He said he could picture what Tom had looked like the night he went to the Naperville house with the aluminum bat, and the authorities were called in to restrain him. We had never heard that story before. Right there and then, we had to stop Benny from telling us the story of Tom's final hour so that he could first tell us the story of the aluminum bat. Benny was shocked we'd never heard that story. He was sure we had. Nope, we never had. "Get out of here," he said. "You heard that story." No, we hadn't. This was always how these conversations went. So Benny told us the story of Tom and the bat, and then he told us the story of Tom's final hour. Both were good stories, and together they killed a good hour. Some of us loved killing an hour of the company's time, and others felt guilty for it afterwards. But whatever your personal feelings on the matter, you still had to account for the hour, so you billed it to a client. By the end of the fiscal year, our clients had paid us a substantial amount of money to sit around and BS, expenses they then passed on to you, the consumer. It was the cost of doing business, but some of us feared it was an indication that the end was near, like the profligacy that preceded the downfall of the Roman Empire. There was so much money involved, and some of it even trickled down to us. A small amount that allowed us to live among the top 1% of the wealthiest in the world. It was lasting fun until layoffs came. Tom wanted to throw his computer against the window, but only if he could guarantee it would break the glass and land on the street below. He was under his desk, removing cords. "That's 62 stories, Tom," Benny said. And Tom agreed it was a bad idea if he couldn't break the glass. Of glass didn't break, they would say Tom Moda couldn't even screw up right. He didn't want to give them the satisfaction of that, the bastards. We were the bastards he was referring to, in part. "But I don't think it'll break the glass," said Benny. Tom stopped tooling around with his computer. "But I gotta do something," he said, sitting back on his heels. We lacked that kind of urgency. Our building was on the Magnificent Mile in downtown Chicago, on a corner a few blocks from Lake Michigan. It had tones of Art Deco and two gilded revolving doors. We shuffled up the stairs toward the revolving doors slowly, afraid of what waited us inside. In the beginning, we were let go in large numbers. Then, as the practice was refined, one by one, as they saw fit, we feared ending up on Lower Wacker Drive. Unemployed, we would be unpaid. Unpaid, we'd be evicted from our homes. Evicted, we would end up on Lower Wacker, sharing space with shopping carts and developing our own winterized and blackened feet. Instead of scrabbling for the addition of senior to our current titles, we would search the alleyways for smokable butts. It was fun, imagining our eventual despair. It was also despairing. We didn't really believe we would be honked at from the Lexuses of our former colleagues as they drove down Lower Wacker on their way home to the suburbs. We didn't think we'd be forced to wave at them from our lit oil drums. But that we might have to fill out an unemployment form over the internet was not out of the question. That we might struggle to make rent or mortgage payment was a real and frightening prospect. Yet we were still alive. We had to remember that. The sun still shone in as we sat at our desks. Certain days it was enough just to look out at the clouds and at the tops of buildings. We were buoyed by it momentarily. It made us happy. We can even turn uncommonly kind. Take, for instance, the time we smuggled old golds into Frank Brizalera's hospital room. Or when we attended the funeral of Janine Gorjank's little girl, found strangled in an empty lot. It was hard for us to believe something like that could happen to someone we knew. You've never seen someone weep until you've witnessed a mother at the funeral of her murdered child. The girl was 9 years old. She was removed at night from an open window. It was all over the papers. First she was missing, then her body was found. To watch Janine at the funeral, surrounded by pictures of Jessica, her family trying to hold her up, even Tom Moda's heart broke. We were outside the funeral home afterward in the parking lot, speaking somberly to one another, when Tom began to beat on his 94 Miata. It didn't take long before everyone noticed him. He hit the windows with his fists and let out terrible cries of one word, over and over. He kicked the doors and the tires. Finally, he collapsed near the trunk, racked with sobs. It was not unreasonable behavior given the circumstances, but we were a little surprised that Tom appeared the most affected. He was sprawled out in the funeral home parking lot in his suit and tie, sobbing like a child. A few people went over to comfort him. We assumed, in part, his behavior had something to do with his ex-wife taking his kids to Phoenix. One thing we knew for certain, despite all our certainties, it was very difficult to guess what one individual was thinking at any given moment. We believed that downturns had been rendered obsolete by the ingenious technology of the new economy. We thought ourselves immune from things like plant closings in Iowa and Nebraska, where remote Americans struggled against falling-in roofs and credit card debt. We watched these blue-collar workers being interviewed on TV. For the length of the segment, it was impossible not to feel the sadness and anxiety they must have felt for themselves and their families. But soon we moved on to weather and sports, and by the time we thought about them again, it was a different plant in a different city, and the state was offering dislocated worker programs, readjustment and retraining services, and skills workshops. They'd be fine. Thank God we didn't have to worry about misfortune like that. We were corporate citizens, buttressed by advanced degrees and padded by corporate fat. We were above the fickle market forces of overproduction and mismanaged inventory. What we didn't consider was that in a downturn, we were the mismanaged inventory, and we were about to be dumped like a glut of imported circuit boards. On the drive home, we puzzled over who was next. Scott McMichaels was next. His wife had just had a baby. Sharon Turner was next. She and her husband had just purchased a house. Names, just names to anyone else, but to us they were the individuals who generated our greatest sympathy. The ones who put their things in a box, shook a few hands, and left without complaint. They had no choice in the matter, and they possessed a quiet resignation to their ill-timed fates. As they departed, it almost felt to us like self-sacrifice. They left so that we might stay. And stay we did, though our hearts went out to them. Then there was Tom Moda, who wanted to throw his computer against the window. He wore a goatee and was built like a bulldog, stocky, with foreshortened limbs and a rippling succession of necks. He didn't belong where we were. That's not condescension so much as an attempt at a charitable truth. He would have been happier elsewhere, felling trees in a forest or throwing nets for an Alaskan fishery. Instead, he was dressed in khakis, drinking a latte on a sectional sofa, discussing the best way to make our diaper client's brand synonymous with more absorbent. That is, when we still had our diaper client. After deciding not to throw his computer against the window, Tom fixated on his magazines. He said to Benny, "Benny, man, you gotta get my magazines from Jim. That prick's had them for 2 months. I'm not leaving here without them. But I can't go out there. I don't want to have to see anybody." When Benny told us that, we felt pity for Tom. Of course, Tom would not have wanted that. He would have spat our pity back in our faces. Nobody wants pity. They just want to get the hell out of there, out of sight, to alleviate the sting of ridicule. Then they want to forget about the entire miserable experience. They can't do that walking the halls to retrieve magazines. Benny returned to Tom's office 10 minutes later with back copies of Car and Driver, Rolling Stone, Guns and Ammo. Tom was sitting on the floor of his office, winding his watch. Benny said, "Tom." Tom did not answer. "Tom," said Benny. Tom continued to wind his watch. Then he stood, opened a desk drawer, and pulled out one of the corporate polos he used to wear many days in a row. The blue one, Benny's, and the green one, Jim's, were also in the desk drawer. Tom took off his button-down and put the red polo on. "They think I'm a clown," he said to Benny. Benny replied, "No, nobody thinks you're a clown, Tom. They got you by the balls, man. Everybody knows that." "Hand me those scissors," said Tom. Benny said he looked behind him and saw a pair of scissors on Tom's bookshelf. Benny told us he didn't want to hand scissors to Tom. "They think I'm a clown," Tom repeated as he walked over to his bookshelf and grabbed the scissors himself and began to cut into his nice pleated slacks at the knee. "What are you doing, Tom?" asked Benny with an uneasy chuckle. He was still holding Tom's old magazines. He watched as Tom cut all the way around with the scissors until the trouser leg fell to his ankle. Then he started working on one sleeve of the polo on the opposite side of the cut-off trouser leg. "Tom," said Benny. Tom's tan-lined arm was soon visible all the way up to the shoulder. A tattoo of barbed wire snaked around his bicep. "Tom, seriously, what are you doing?" "Will you do me a favor?" asked Tom. "Cut a hole from the backside of my shirt?" "Tom, why are you doing this?" Then he went down the elevator with Tom. With his clothes cut to shreds, Tom looked like someone washed up on shore after a shipwreck, tattered and clinging to a single plank. His shoes and socks were off, left inside the office with the abandoned magazines, the Kmart portraits of his kids, and the discarded swatches from his trousers and polo. "What are you going to do?" asked Benny. "What do you think I'm going to do?" Tom said rhetorically, just as they reached the lobby. "I'm going to find a new job." "No," said Benny. "I mean right now. What are you doing right now?" They exited the elevator. Tom had emptied out the pens and pencils from a mug he kept on his desk, and that empty mug was now his only possession. Tom stopped in the marble elevator bank and watched for the descent of the other elevators. You ever read Ralph Waldo Emerson? Tom asked Benny. Betty didn't know where to stand. He told us he didn't know why they had just stopped in the elevator bank. What are you planning to do, Tom? Listen to what Emerson said, Tom began to quote. For all our penny wisdom, for all our soul-destroying slavery to habit, it is not to be doubted that all men have sublime thoughts. Did you hear that, Benny? Did you hear it, or you need me to repeat it to you? I heard it, Benny replied. They never knew me, Tom said, shaking his head and pointing up at those bastards. They never did. The first elevator arrived, and lunchgoers from the law firm emerged. Tom held his empty mug before him. Help out the unemployed? He asked them, shaking the cup. Hey, help out the jobless? Tom, said Benny. Benny, get the hell off me. Hey, help me out, guy, please. I just lost my job today. And that was Tom's final hour. We heard it from Benny just after he told us the story of how Tom arrived at the Naperville house with an aluminum bat when he knew the children were at the grandmother's and everything deemed legally Tom's in the divorce settlement, everything that was Tom's and could be smashed or shattered with an aluminum bat, suffered Tom's swing until the authorities arrived to subdue him. Amber Ludwig, who had the compact, athletic body of a seal, very small hands and dark, closely set eyes, said she feared Tom was going to return like you hear on the news and open fire. No, seriously, she said. I think he's come undone. I don't think he was ever done to begin with. Amber wasn't showing yet, but everyone already knew. She was debating an abortion, but to Larry Novotny's great disappointment, looked to be leaning against it. Larry would have to decide what to do about his wife, who had just had a child herself not that long ago. We felt sorry for Larry, who worried the curved, finger-smudged bill of his Cubs cap endlessly that spring. But we also thought it was pretty obvious that he should have kept it in his pants. We felt sorry for Amber, too, but as everyone knows, it takes two to tango. We just hoped they weren't doing it on our desks. We asked Amber if she really honestly thought Tom capable of a bloodbath. Yes, she said. I wouldn't put anything past him. He's a madman. We tried to convince her that that sort of thing happened only in factories and warehouses, and then only on the South Side. A debate ensued. Was Tom certifiable, or was he just a clown? What was that at Janine's little girl's funeral, when he wept and continued weeping even after we got to the bar? Wasn't that proof the guy had a heart? Okay, said Amber, okay. But what do you call standing on the heating vent and mooning the swimmers from his office window? What was that? She asked. She was referring to the Holiday Inn rooftop pool Tom's office looked down on, and Tom's tendency to get right up to the glass with his butt cheeks. Hijinks, we cried. Fun! That's not insanity. Amber was outvoted. We knew Tom. We knew Alan Glow. Linda Blanton. Paul Sonier. We knew Neil Hotchkiss and Coralie Brower. Harold Oak. They weren't any of them coming back here with a nightmare and a backpack. They'd been let go. They packed their things. They left us for good, never to return.
Bright and early for the daily races, tears are filling up their glasses. No expression, no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kinda funny, I find it kinda sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad
austerity measures began in the lobby with the flowers and bowls of candy. Benny liked to smell the flowers. "I miss the nice flowers," he said. Then we got an office-wide memo taking away our summer days. "I miss my summer days even more than the flowers," he remarked. At an all-agency meeting the following month, they announced a hiring freeze. Next thing we knew, no one was receiving a bonus. "I couldn't give a damn about summer days," he said, "but my bonus now, too?" Finally, layoffs began. "Hey, flowers, summer days, bonuses, fine by me," said Benny. "Just leave me my job." At first we called it what you would expect, getting laid off, being let go. Then we got creative. We said he'd gotten the axe, she'd been sacked, they'd all been canned. Lately a new phrase had appeared and really taken off. Walking Spanish down the hall. Somebody had picked it up from a Tom Waits song, but it was an old, old expression, as we learned from our Morris Dictionary of Word and Phrase Origins. "In the days of piracy on the Spanish Main," Morris writes, "a favorite trick of pirates was to lift their captives by the scruff of the neck and make them walk with their toes barely touching the deck." That sounded about right to us. In the song, Tom Waits sings about walking toward an execution. And that sounded right, too. We'd watch the singled out walk the long, carpeted hallway with the office coordinator leading the way, and then he or she would disappear behind Lynn Mason's door. A few minutes later, we'd see the lights dim from the voltage drop, and we'd hear the electricity sizzle. The smell of cooked flesh would waft out into the insulated spaces. We would turn at our desks and watch the planes descend into O'Hare. We would put our headphones on. We'd lean our heads back and close our eyes. We all had the same thought. Thank God it wasn't me. A fun thing to do to let off steam after layoffs began was to go into someone's office and send an email from their computer addressed to the entire agency. You might say something simple like, "My name is Shawnee, you are captured, ha! I poopy, I poopy, I poopy." People came in the morning and read that, and the reactions were so varied. Jim Jackers read it and immediately sent out an email that read, "Obviously, someone came into my office last night and composed an email in my name and sent it out to everyone. I apologize for any inconvenience or offense, although it was not my fault, and I would appreciate from whoever did this a public apology. I've read that email 5 times now, and I still don't even understand it." We know who did it. We all knew. There was never an apology. Jim knew who did it because he was one of us, and Jim confronted Tom Moda about it. This was some months before Tom walked Spanish. What do you think Tom did? Tom told Benny about the encounter at lunch and about how Jim's fury was off the charts and how Tom egged Smalls on to hit him. Smalls was Tom's nickname for Jim, though both men were about the same height. "Come on, Smalls, you little weasel, please hit me," Tom told Benny he told Jim, and how funny it all was. We were only into our 3rd month of layoffs then. Jim never left the office again without closing out of his email program. Tom's emails were not always antic provocations. Sometimes they were earnest and came from his own computer. We were amused by his sincere tone and his talk of man's infinite worthiness. These heartfelt, long-winded missives, sentiment wildly clashing with Tom's real-life behavior, were laughably inappropriate, schizophrenic in tone and content, and always welcome respite in an otherwise ordinary day. He was written up for their profanities and for composing them on company time because he had the balls to send them not only to all of us, including Lynn Mason, but to the other partners as well, always organizing the send-to list according to seniority, an unspoken rule. He also CC'd the accounts people, the media buyers, project services, human resources, the support staff, and the barista manning the coffee bar. "I passed a bad night last night," his final email in this vein began. The subject line read, "I consign you and your golf shoes to Lower Wacker Drive." "The tomatoes in my garden are not coming out," he continued. "Maybe because I only have the weekend to work the garden, or maybe because the garden keeps getting mowed over by the goddamn Hispanics who tend to the grounds of the apartment complex I've been living in since the state forced me to sell my house in Naperville and Barbara took the kids to Phoenix to live with Pilot Bob. Do I have an actual garden?" The answer to that is a big fat no, because the goddamn woman in the property office won't listen to reason. She keeps insisting that this is a rental property, not your backyard. "Flower borders, that's all we want," she says. So the goddamn Hispanics go out and tend the marigolds along the borders. But do you understand? I'm talking about fat, ripe, juicy, delicious red tomatoes that I want to grow with my own 2 hands through the bountiful mystery and generosity of nature. That dream ended when Barbara started sleeping with Pilot Bob and we gave up Naperville. Anyway, would I like a garden? Yes. Matter of fact, I would like a farm. But at the present moment, I'm afraid all I have is apartment 4H at Bell Harbor Manor, which is neither a harbor nor a manor and contains not one single bell. Which one of you wit wizards came up with the name Bell Harbor Manor? May your clever tongues be ripped from their cushy red linings and left to dry on pikes under the native sun of a cannibal land. Ah! I will be called into the office for that one, but I'm leaving it. Because what I'm trying to get at here is that I'm not sure any of us knows just how far we have removed ourselves. Not only from nature, but from the natural conditions of life that have prevailed for centuries and have forced men to the extreme limits of their physical capacity in order to simply to feed, clothe, and otherwise provide for our families, sending them every night to a sweet, exhausted, restorative, unstirred, deserved sleep such as we will never know again. Thank you. Now there's Phoenix and Pilot Bob. Airplanes to get you there. Pilot Bob, who can take care of everything, though he probably doesn't even know how to mow his own lawn. But don't forget, Bob, and all you Bobs out there, that manual labor is the study of the external world. I believe that to be true. Now, the question you're all probably asking yourselves is, what is he doing then, Tom Moda? Why is Tom wasting his days in a carpeted office trying to hide the coffee stain on his khakis? How is he any better than Pilot Bob? Unfortunately, I don't think I am any better. I'm not studying the external world. What I'm doing is trying to generate a buck for a client, so as to generate a quarter for us, so that I can generate a nickel for me and have a penny left over after Barbara gets what the court demands. For that reason, I love my job and never want to lose it. So I hope no one reading this finds me smug or ungrateful. I'm only trying to suggest that as we find ourselves in this particularly unfortunate, misconstrued, ungodly juncture of civilization, let's not lose sight of the nobler manifestations of man and of the greater half of his character, which consists not of taglines and bottom lines, but of love, heroism, reciprocity, ecstasy, kindness, and truth. Yeah, what a bloated bunch of horse crap, you will say. And good for you. I welcome you to shoot me up close in the head. Peace. Tom. Not long after hitting send, Tom was let go. And if not for the paltry severance, we might have been inclined to think that his was not another in a series of layoffs, but an outright firing. But the truth was, Tom was probably in the pipeline already. His email just hastened things along the way pneumonia can spell doom for a cancer patient. Like so many others, Tom walked Spanish.
He got himself a homemade special. You know his glass is full of sand. And it feels just like a jaybird. The way it fits into his hand. He rolled a blade up in his trick towel. They slapped their hands against the wall. You never trip, you never stumble. He's walking Spanish down the hall. Slip him a picture of...